1106.
Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscoane. It was a discovery that would dramatically change cancer research and treatment, and it all started with a single cell that was missing a piece of DNA. The Philadelphia chromosome, as it came to be called, became the key that unlocked the mystery of how to treat cancer at the genetic level. Years after its discovery in Philadelphia in 1959, it led to the development of the wonder drug that stops a deadly form of blood cancer in its tracks. The Philadelphia chromosome is the title and subject of a new book by science journalist Jessica Wapner. Her work has appeared in Scientific American, Late, The New York Times, and a number of other publications. Jessica's here to share the fascinating story of how the Philadelphia chromosome was discovered and the groundbreaking cancer research that followed. Jessica, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how did you first hear about the Philadelphia chromosome?
It was around the year 2000. I was working at a medical journal, and I would see these words, the Philadelphia chromosome, in articles I was working on. It was around the time that this breakthrough drug that I write about was emerging, the data were emerging, and I found this phrase so captivating, the Philadelphia chromosome. What's that? Years later, when I became a full-time writer, I dug into the story, and it began with a question of why was this genetic mutation called the Philadelphia chromosome? And yeah.
And it is a genetic mutation. I mean, tell us, what exactly is the Philadelphia chromosome?
So the Philadelphia chromosome was, as you said, first discovered in 1959 by two scientists in Philadelphia, Peter Noel and David Hungerford. What they noticed at the time in samples of blood cells from patients with chronic myeloid leukemia was that one of the chromosomes, chromosome 22, was too short. It was abnormally small. At that time, they didn't know if this was a mutation that was causing the cancer, if the cancer was causing the mutation. There was no way to puzzle that out. About 10, 12 years later, Janet Rowley at the University of Chicago brought in the next piece of the puzzle of what this mutation was actually about, what was going on. And what she found was that not only was chromosome 22 too small, chromosome 9 was too big. So it was a swap, or what's called a translocation, this tiny swapping of genetic material that was enough to cause this fatal blood cancer.
So what happened in the intervening time? So it's discovered in 59. It's 10, 11, 12 years later that now more research is done. What happened in those 10 years?
Well, on the one hand, not very much, because there wasn't the technology to do anything. That was one of the things that happened after David at Hungerford and Peter Noel found this mutation, was they couldn't do anything with it. They couldn't study it. There was no way people could look at chromosomes, but they couldn't see inside chromosomes. By 1971, there was this new technique called banding. But in the intervening years, there was all kinds of other research going on that would eventually connect up to CML, to this genetic mutation, but it wasn't until years later that the whole picture came together.
So you basically had this amazing discovery, but there was really not much you could do with the information for a long time.
That's right. They really didn't know how amazing it was. I mean, it was a 300-word abstract published in a scientific journal. And as one scientist that I interviewed said to me, years later, it was 300 words, and it changed everything. Wow. But for that change to happen, it would take decades.
Yeah. So it was hugely significant, but it sort of stopped cold at that point until the technology could be developed where more research could be done.
That's right. And in other laboratories, work going on to try to unravel how cancer occurred, how a normal cell went from being healthy and happy to becoming cancerous. That was ongoing for years, of course, but it wasn't until the mid-80s that all came together.
Yeah. So were people born with this mutation? Did it develop at a certain point in their lives? How did that work?
It's a spontaneous mutation. That can happen in our lives. Our DNA in replicating can have a mistake, basically. Sometimes those mistakes go away. They can be harmless. We won't even know about them. Sometimes something harmful happens. And in this case, the Philadelphia chromosome, this tiny change, is enough to cause this fatal blood cancer. But it's rare. It's diagnosed in about 5,000 people in the U.S. per year. and up to 75,000 worldwide.
And we'll talk about that rarity a little bit later in terms of how that could be the bad news in terms of getting the resources to create the drug and everything else. But tell us about what CML is. It sounds like it was pretty much a death sentence at that point.
Absolutely, it was. Chronic myeloid leukemia is, well, first of all, the word chronic refers to the fact that it progresses slowly, as opposed to acute leukemias, which move very fast. But still, it's not that slow. A person diagnosed with chronic myeloid leukemia, left untreated, would probably have 4 to 6 years to live on average. Leukemias are cancers of the white blood cells. They're part of the so-called liquid cancers. What happens in CML is that the bone marrow becomes filled with blast cells, which are immature white blood cells that fail to mature. They're dysfunctional. They don't do anything. And they fill up the marrow and they leave no space for other blood cells, red, white, healthy blood cells.
So what happens ultimately to someone who has that condition and they have this overload of the white cells?
Mm-hmm. Well, they'll become very tired, anemic from the lack of red blood cells. Eventually, the blood could fail to clot. So when you get a cut, you would bleed, unstoppingly bleeding. The spleen could become profoundly enlarged from the profusion of white blood cells inside. The capillaries can burst from the overabundance of blood cells, and I mean, death is obviously the end result.
So Brian Druker enters the story somewhere around 1984, maybe?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I write about his whole medical career, but yes, it was when this picture became complete in the 1980s that Brian Druker and some other people started thinking about making a drug to target this root cause.
And he would become a pivotal person
in
this whole story. Tell us about him, because it sounds like he almost stumbled on this, that he sort of entered this whole world almost reluctantly, was my sense.
It was reluctant at first, because as he told me, when he was first thinking about becoming a cancer doctor, he was embarrassed to tell anyone, because cancer was a death sentence. And so there was a time when people who were going into that were considered crazy. You know, why would you want to spend your life treating people who were almost inevitably going to die of their disease no matter what you did? Yeah. You could be the best doctor in the world and you still couldn't do very much. Yeah. And he was there, he was treating patients, seeing them die, and just wanting there to be something better, as we all do. After he got his medical degree, he went back into the laboratory and started researching. And there was a time in the early 90s where his career was kind of at a standstill. He had some bad news with his career and didn't know what to do, didn't know where to go. And at the same time, is reading about the Philadelphia chromosome and what that has to do with CML. And he says, you know, there is going to be a drug to target cancer at its root cause, and CML will be the first disease to fall to this. And I want to be there to help make this drug.
And he really almost had to start from scratch, just in terms of, he talks about feeling like he was in over his head as a researcher.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, he had had this, you know, medical training and had become pretty competent treating cancer patients, and then went into the laboratory, and he says they were speaking this language I just did not understand. And of course it was the language of research, laboratory research, as opposed to bedside care.
Yeah. So it was a completely different world that he was entering at that point.
Yeah. And he spent a couple of years climbing that ladder. But the research that he was doing put him in touch with people in the pharmaceutical industry. So it was actually very lucky, because he was working on a project that had the exact ingredient that people in the pharmaceutical industry needed to start testing compounds of this kind. So they were like, oh, we want to talk to that guy.
Yeah.
partnership was born.
And you mentioned that there was other research going on in addition to, you know, what was happening with the Philadelphia chromosome. Mm-hmm. But there were some other things happening. What else was going on that eventually would sort of sync up with the research on the Philadelphia chromosome?
Right. Well, one of the avenues of research was all about these proteins called kinases and their role in cancer. Because how the Philadelphia chromosome works is that this mutant gene, its protein product, as it's called, is a kinase, which is a kind of protein that these proteins set processes in motion in our cells. So kinase, kinetic, it's in the name. It puts mm-hmm. things into motion. In this case, the mutant gene encodes a mutant kinase, and that mutant kinase is what is triggering the haywire production of white blood cells. Mm. And it was the whole avenue of research that uncovered the role of kinases in cancer. This wasn't the first kinase discovered that was involved in cancer, but it turned people's attention to it. And so when someone found out that the Philadelphia chromosome encoded a kinase, it was, aha, we are getting to the heart of the matter here. And that was when people inside a company called Ziba Geigy in Switzerland and Brian Druker and other people around the world started saying, can we make a compound to block this mutant kinase, yeah. to throw a wrench in the clockwork?
And I imagine that the race was on at mm-hmm. that point, right? Because now word spreads that, hey, we're onto something with this, and that people start picking up on that research.
Yeah, on the one hand, it was a race. And on the other hand, it was just everyone trying to figure out how to do this. Because it didn't exist before. There was no way to screen compounds for efficacy against a haywire protein. Mm-hmm. This had never been done. Cancer treatment was always this sort of very general carpet bombing of the body with chemotherapy, right? Yeah. Poison therapy, maybe targeting the fastest growing cells, but certainly not targeting one tiny specific protein in a cell. So they were everyone was just trying to figure out, yeah. how are we going to do this?
I mean, this was a completely different way of looking at treatment.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I love what you said in your book. I want to just read this quick passage because it shows your writing style, which I really enjoyed. But you said in the chapter on that word is oncogenes, you said, the way the Philadelphia chromosome led to CML was a story that unfolded like 100 painters applying brushes to a canvas at some time or another over 25 years, driven only by curiosity and sometimes a vague hope that their work might eventually be relevant to human cancer. There'd been no final picture in mind and no awareness that they were even painting something together. And yet, there it was, a scientific masterpiece.
It really was a scientific masterpiece. The way that everything came together in those years from the discovery of the chromosome in 1959, and actually I write about research that goes back to 1910 even, until the mid-80s, right, when people started asking, can we make this drug? It was these threads of research coming together, and people had no idea that they were even, you know, creating this masterpiece, and yet there it was.
There it was. We are talking about the Philadelphia chromosome, a mutant gene and the quest to cure cancer at the genetic level. Our guest is Jessica Wapner, the author of that book. We'll talk more about the Philadelphia chromosome, and we'll hear from you when Radio Times comes right back.
The Mann Center supports WHYY and presents Michael Feinstein and Tony Award winners Christine Ebersole and Betty Buckley in an evening of Broadway and the American Songbook's greatest hits, Friday, August 2nd. A night with the ambassador of the American Songbook and two Broadway legends that the whole family can enjoy. Tickets for Michael Feinstein and Friends, Friday, August 2nd, and All Mann Concerts are available at 215-893-1999 or manncenter.org.
With all the hype about the attitudes about blacks and marriage, you might think you've heard it all, but a new survey on African-American life offers new insights.
We were particularly surprised, for example, by one finding about the dating lives of black single men versus black single women.
A new Harvard NPR poll on black attitudes about marriage and more. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Rosenfeld Cancer Center at Abington Memorial Hospital supports WHYY and offers the services of both a comprehensive cancer center and a hospital that handles complex medical needs. Oncologists are on call around the clock. An emergency trauma center is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. A team of specialized physicians is available if other health issues arise. To learn more, amh.org/cancer. Abington Memorial Hospital, the power to heal.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowane, and we are talking about the Philadelphia chromosome. If you've never heard of it, there is such a chromosome. It also happens to be the title of a new book by Jessica Wapner. Jessica is a science journalist, and the subtitle of the book is A Mutant Gene and the Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level. We would love to have your calls as well if you have questions about this, but this Philadelphia chromosome ultimately led to a wonder drug that gave a lot of people and continues to give people their lives back who have been diagnosed with this deadly blood cancer. The number to call if you'd like to join our conversation is 888-477-9499. And Jessica, we were talking about the compound that was eventually developed. And of course, there's lots and lots of testing that has to take place, first on animals. Tell us a little bit about what that round of testing was like.
What happened is that once Brian Druker and people at Ciba Geigy were having this vision of creating a compound, they set to work creating it. And it took a couple of years, and they had made this compound that could get into a cell, hit this specific kinase, and be active against cells. They had sent a bunch of compounds to Brian Druker, not telling him which one was the one they thought was working. He tested them on CML cells and saw right away one of them was working. And it was, of course, the same one that they knew was working. And Brian Druker even gave it to one of his students with the same blind test, not telling him which one was working. And the student found the same thing. Wow. And as one of the chemists in Ciba Geigy told me, she had been leading the test of each compound as it came out of the Ciba Geigy lab. And she said when she heard this from Brian Druker, she said it was already a little bit of a miracle.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, of course, after that came the animal test, which took some time. There were delays. And this was, you know, you would think once seeing these stunning results in the lab that the company would be moving into animal testing very fast. That's the well-worn process for drug development. But it was more like everything kind of ground to a halt. And this is, of course, where the story takes a different turn, which is not will the drug be made, but how will this drug be made? Because there were obstacles at every turn. As Alex Matter put it to me, he was leading the company's program, and he would, you know, at every turn it was, and that was when the trouble began. No, and that was when the trouble began. And in the animal tests, well, this drug was tested on a lot of animals. The animal studies went on for about a year and a half, maybe a little more than that. It was tested on mice, of course, and dogs and rats and monkeys and rabbits and I think hamsters or other cell lines as well. So they were pretty extensive. And there were a couple of different reasons for why that was going on for so long.
Now, did they see immediate results in animal testing the way that they were able to see in the lab?
Well, what they're doing with the animal tests is testing the drug for safety. That's the primary reason, is it's toxicologists who lead the animal studies. And there was a long time where Brian Druker was sort of, you know, drumming his hands on the table, wondering, you know, when am I going to hear any results? What's going on? And eventually he heard from the company that the drug was causing toxicity in dogs. It had caused some liver toxicity. There were some other problems with blood clots that the company thought was a result of using one formulation versus another, so they changed to an intravenous formulation. When this liver toxicity happened, this was kind of a huge red flag. They did not want to push the drug any further. One of the toxicologists actually said to Alex Matter, "No way, not over my dead body."
Which was one of the chapters in your book.
Yeah. And the problem was that as Brian Druker saw it, you know, he was a professional. He was a doctor. If he sees signs of liver toxicity, he would know how to treat it. Mm-hmm. He would know to stop the drug. Eventually, of course, it did go into clinical trials in 1998.
What did Brian Druker or any of the other researchers tell you about those waiting periods? I mean, meanwhile, you've got people with CML. People are dying while mm-hmm. this testing is playing out. What is it like for a researcher to have to wait it out like that, knowing the promise of a compound like this?
Yeah, I think it was pretty horrible. I mean, the way that he describes it was kind of excruciating. Not only is his, you know, this is his career. On the one hand, he thinks that this drug has promise. He would see other items coming out in the scientific literature that would indicate other people were also on the trail of creating a so-called kinase inhibitor. And he wanted to be among the people making the breakthrough. He, you know, there was that professional drive. But of course, that came second to just getting this drug to patients. He had seen so many people die from cancer. I mean, as we all have experienced a loved one, somebody that we know suffering, he had just seen it so many times. He had made this promise to the families of patients of his who had died, saying, I'm going to go into the laboratory and I'm not coming out until I have mm-hmm. something better. And he so wanted to fulfill that promise. He so wanted something better. And he knew that this drug was it. He knew it yeah. with the whole of himself. So I think it was fairly excruciating, all the waiting.
Yeah, especially for someone as passionate as he was. I mean, this really became his life.
It really did.
This pursuit.
It really did. It was 100-hour weeks. His first marriage had failed because he was just so dedicated to his work and not so much to yeah. his personal life. Weekends were like, what's a weekend? It was all just work.
Well, I remember you saying in the book something like, there was one point where he thought, great, I can treat patients one day and stay in touch with them, and then the other 6 days I can be in the lab.
That's right.
It never even would have occurred to him
yeah.
that you take a day off.
Right.
So how did we then move from the animal testing to getting it to the point where we could do human testing with it?
Well, that was, of course, the long saga that I describe in the book, and eventually, as I said, it did go into clinical trials in 1998. The animal studies went on. A lot of the people who were within the company fighting for this drug to get made, to them it was too long. You know, they were like, no, these animal studies went on for far too long. But importantly, the company did the right thing in the end. They put it into a clinical trial for a couple of reasons. And one of them was that it was an opportunity to prove the principle. You know, Brian Druker had written to the company saying, give the drug a chance. Just give it yeah. a chance. You have patients with this fatal disease. You have a drug that could work. We know how to read the signs of toxicity. Just give it a chance.
Yeah.
If it doesn't work, fine. You've done very little investing if it doesn't work.
Right.
But if it does work, you've potentially not just saved countless number of lives with this new drug, you've created a whole new domain of drug development for cancer yeah. research.
Was some of the reluctance on the part of the drug company that CML was a relatively rare disease to begin with?
Yeah, that's right. There was this whole other side to the story, which was not only that there was a risk involved with would this drug be toxic, because it had never been tried before to hit one protein. And as many animal studies as you do, you still never really know what's going to happen when you give the drug to people. But then, yes, there was this whole other side, which was that CML is a rare disease, as we talked about, and the company, the financial analysts of the company, could not see how was the drug going to recoup on its investment. The patient population, or what's called in business terms, the market, was too small. There just weren't enough patients to guarantee that the formidable investment that is a clinical trial was going to pay off.
Yeah.
So they held off for a long time.
So then people like Brian Druker are sort of caught in between the business end of things and the human side of things, which they're faced with every day.
That's right.
Yeah.
He had, after the first clinical trial opened, a few months into the study, they could see that this drug was working. I mean, it was miraculous. At one point, the response rates were 100%. People getting their blood counts returned to normal and feeling great. When it was time to get this drug to more patients, because phase one studies are tiny, it was very difficult to get the company to see that they needed to ramp up production. And even after those early responses were seen, Brian Druker still wasn't sure that the drug was even going to be made.
Wow. And that really gets us to the point where, you know, people started hearing about it, right? After after a while, people started hearing that there is this experimental drug that really seems to be having great results.
Yes. The story of the Philadelphia chromosome is amazing in its serendipity. And one of those serendipitous moments was the fact that this struggle to get the drug made was perfectly timed with the arising of chat rooms. So there would be these patient forums, these online e-groups and such. Because CML being rare, you're not going to find too many people nearby you.
Right.
Right, to go meet with in person.
That you can just have coffee with or something.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And when you're going through cancer, well, you can meet with anyone being treated for cancer, but to meet with people who have your same disease, who are going through your same treatment, is really important because you want to know what to expect with the drugs and everything. So people were starting to turn to the internet.
And this is early 90s, maybe?
This was late 90s,
late 90s.
At this point. Yeah.
Okay.
So patients who were not on the clinical trial were going online just to exchange information about the treatments, because the other treatments before Gleevec, as this drug is called, was approved, were very harsh. And so it was very helpful to talk to other people. What are you going through? What do you do for this? What do you do for that? But then at the same time, patients who were enrolled in the phase one study would come home from their doctor's visits every day and checkups and report everything. All their blood counts, everything they were going through, the fact that they had no side effects, the fact that they were feeling great. They had even started giving the drug to late stage patients at this point. So there were patients who had been, brought in a wheelchair and, you know, a few weeks later were leaving, walking out of the hospital, dancing out of the hospital. So patients were hearing about this and they said, well, I want that drug too. Why can't I have it also?
Well, and that leads me to one patient in particular who was quite sick, as I recall from your book, who was following all of this and essentially said, well, what do you mean I can't have this drug? I have to figure out a way to get this. Tell us about her case, because she became a pivotal character as well in getting the drug company to manufacture more.
Yeah, absolutely. Susan McNamara, she was a patient in Toronto. She was living between her bed and her computer 2 feet away. She was on this drug called interferon, which would work for a while, but was incredibly toxic. And eventually would stop working for most people.
Yeah. And let me just interrupt you there, Jessica, because I remember in your book people saying, I'd rather die than go back to taking that. I mean, it was a pretty harsh treatment.
Yeah. Interferon is like having the flu. So when our bodies get a flu virus, we produce interferon naturally to get rid of it. So all the symptoms of a flu is interferon at work. Mm-hmm. So when you take interferon, the synthetic drug interferon, it's like walking around with flu symptoms, but much more severe. And I remember, you know, reading reports from patients talking about sleeping for 22 hours a day. This one CML patient called it his year of sleep. And you don't even remember that year of your life.
That's
right. It causes depression as well. People with clinically diagnosed depression often can't even take interferon. Memory loss. You know, people would describe being in the supermarket, walking down an aisle and forgetting what they had gone there for, or stopping mid-sentence, having no idea what they were on about.
Yeah.
So Susan McNamara was on this drug. She lost a bunch of weight. She was really sick. And she was reading about this drug, and she emailed Brian Druker to ask him if she could come get on his trial. And that was at a really low point for him, where he had a waiting list about 100 patients long, and every time he got a new dose of the drug, he had to choose the sickest patient from his list. He was waiting for the company to ramp up production. He just didn't know. And he said, look, I just don't know what's happening with this drug. It might not even be made. As I learned a new expression, which was file 13. It was in the trash. and she, from her misery, basically, just had this feeling of no way. Just no. Absolutely not. I am going to get this drug. And she started a petition, got hundreds, thousands of signatures in a matter of weeks. And couple months after sending that petition to the drug company, which by now was Novartis, the production was increased. And the phase two trials were open more broadly. It's a vague... The truth might never be known, right? Because, of course, when I spoke with Daniel Vasella, who was the chairman of Novartis at the time, he said the drug was always going to be made. There was a lag time. That's always the case with clinical trials. And this one happened very fast, that it was time to open up the next study very quickly. It was just a delay. And, she says... we'll never know. As Susan McNamara said it to me, we'll never know.
Yeah, but the bottom line is that she really helped open the door.
Absolutely. Absolutely. She put the pressure on, and she made it, her petition made it very clear to the company. I mean, they could read between the lines to say, it was going to be a PR nightmare if they did not get this drug made.
Well, because meantime, Brian Druker is presenting on this topic, right? And people and patients are hearing these presentations, and other doctors are getting wind of it. So now there's a groundswell at this point.
That's right. At the same time that this petition was being sent to Novartis, he was presenting the results of the phase one study with these incredible response rates, just never seen before. 100%, just incredible. The room erupting in applause when he was done, in this room of people in their business suits, a very serious crowd, just erupting, just so happy. And they didn't know, of course, well, would the responses last? But the fact of the matter was, this was a breakthrough. Nothing like this had ever been seen before.
Yeah. Well, and those are some of the things that I want to talk about when we come back from our break, which is going to happen in just a few seconds. And I want to just encourage you, if you have called in and you're waiting to talk to Jessica, hang on, because we will get to your calls. But want to talk about what the results were. I know that Brian Druker was holding his breath and was reluctant to admit even to himself how well this was working. I want to talk to you about that. And also some of the glitches, because while it turned out to be a wonder drug, it was not without its own setbacks. It wasn't entirely foolproof. Mm-hmm. And we want to talk a little bit about that. And just since then, what this drug has done and the second generation and what the developments have been since then. So we're talking about the Philadelphia chromosome. It is a real thing, and it is the title of Jessica Wapner's new book. We'll talk about that and much more when Radio Times comes back.
The National Museum of American Jewish History supports WHYY and kicks off its New Dreamers and Doers speaker series with shoe designer Stuart Weitzman and WHYY's innovations reporter Zach Seward, who will discuss the story of the Stuart Weitzman Company, an intergenerational tale of vision, entrepreneurship, and the American spirit. The event takes place at the museum on Wednesday, June 12th at 7 p.m. Program tickets at www.nmajh.org. Seating is limited.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Attorney General Eric Holder remains under fire for his department's role in seizing phone records of journalists. Is it time for Holder to resign? Also, remembering one of our favorite guests, musician Rob Morseberger. He died over the weekend. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY. the rate of new HIV infection in Philadelphia is 5 times the national average. There are more than 30,000 living with the virus in our city, and 1 in 5 don't know it. June is AIDS Education Month, and Philadelphia Fight is holding events throughout June for youth, faith leaders, medical providers, and the greater community, including National HIV Testing Day on June 27th. All events are open to the public. More about AIDS Education Month at fight.org/AEM. Philadelphia Fight supports WHYY.
And welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We are talking with Jessica Wapner about her new book. It's called The Philadelphia Chromosome, A Mutant Gene and the Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level. And that is exactly what has happened as it relates to CML, chronic myeloid leukemia. We have been talking about the development of Gleevec, which became the wonder drug that gave so many people their lives back. We'd love to hear from you as well as we continue our conversation. The number is 888-477-9499. And I do want to pause right here, Jessica, to go to the phones because we have a caller from Center City, Philadelphia. David is on the line. Welcome, David, to Radio Times.
Hi. My mother died of gastrointestinal stromal tumor in December of 2000. And we had just learned a few weeks prior to that that this drug was becoming open to clinical trials for GIST, as it's called. I've not since then really tracked the efficacy and the results of how it has worked against with GIST. But that's my question, really. When I can't help but feel that we just missed the window by weeks or maybe a month or two. Can you speak to the coincidence of and the timing of Gleevec as it was trialed against GIST?
Yeah, absolutely. And hi. So first, the fact that Gleevec turned out to work against gastrointestinal stromal tumor, I talk about that in the book in terms of how that was even possible. GIST is driven by a kinase called KIT, K-I-T, and it was really a serendipitous thing that this compound, the anti-KIT properties of this compound had been preserved when it was first made in the laboratory. And when it was figured out that GIST tumors were driven by this kinase, they thought, okay, well, let's try it for this disease too, which had no treatments at the time. It also turned out to work amazingly well. The responses don't last as long as in CML, but it is, I mean, profoundly better than what was available before. So I think, and I, you know, I'm sorry to say it, it probably is true that it was a couple of months, timing difference there. And I think that was the case for many patients, of course.
Well, and speaking of patients, there were a number that you singled out in the book. Bud Romine, okay, was one of them. There were a few others, and he was one who had tried the drug at the point where they were still figuring out dosages, right?
Yeah, he was the first patient.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about his experience, because he has a great story.
Yeah, I mean, he was amazing. When he heard about Brian Druker's very first cell studies, remember I talked about he had tested these compounds in his laboratory. He was in Portland by then and saw that one of them was working. There was an article in the newspaper. It didn't cause much of a stir, but there was an article in the Oregonian. And Bud Romine wrote to Brian Druker saying, I have CML. If this ever becomes a drug, I want to be your first patient. And he was. He was the first patient. The problem was that the first patient gets the lowest dose because they're just, you know, testing out the drug. They start at these tiny, tiny amounts, 25 milligrams. Everybody knew that would not do anything. So he's on his 25 milligrams. His leukemia progresses. But he stays on the drug, and a few months later, once they see these responses happening, they get permission from the drug company to up the dose of all the early patients. So he got to come back on the trial and have the dose that was working. I think that he came on at 200 milligrams or 150, 200 milligrams, and he lived for many years. He died, but he did not die of CML.
Wow. And there was another woman who had her funeral planned before she started taking this drug.
Yeah, yeah. LaDonna LaPasa, she was brought into the clinic against her will. I mean, her husband was like, please, can we please just try this? She had chosen her burial plot. She was in a wheelchair. And, you know, very reluctantly agreed. She was ready to go. She had accepted her fate and that there was nothing left for her to try. Her husband had heard about this drug and just kind of begged her to try it. So she was enrolled. And a few weeks later, she was, like I said, one of these people walking out of the hospital. She's still alive. 10 years later, she's, you know, energetic, happy, and well.
No one would ever have imagined at the time that she was wheeled into that hospital that would happen.
Yeah.
I want to go back to the phones to Phoenixville, and we'll welcome Eric to our conversation. Hi, Eric.
Hi there. I sure appreciate your show today. I was listening, thinking about my mother who contracted CML back in 1990, and we believe it was from her exposure to some nuclear tests back in Nevada in the 50s, but at any rate, she was given at the time about 3 years to live, and as a family, we kind of gathered around and were preparing for that. She was on interferon, and to your point, she had all the attendant problems and symptoms with that. And then they found this Gleevec drug. We were kind of hoping as a family there might be a wonder drug, and boom, all of a sudden, there was this drug. And she went on it. Her counts went, you know, to normal almost immediately. And what was to be 3 years has now been 23 years, and she will likely pass away from something else.
Amazing.
She's now 79 and doing quite well.
How wonderful, Eric. Thank you for sharing that with us. What a great story.
Yeah.
So, Jessica, here's the thing, though. As with any drug, there are side effects, and not everyone responds ideally to these drugs. What was the experience with Gleevec?
So, on the one hand, it was really a miracle drug. It is not a kind of grandiose statement to call it that. Here was a pill that you take once a day for the rest of your life, and the cancer stays at bay. It's not a cure, because if you stop taking the drug, the cancer most likely will return, and causes mostly minimal side effects. For most people, almost no side effects. The most significant, obvious side effect is puffy eyes, bags under the eyes. Which is a small price to pay.
Right. Relative to the alternative, right?
Yeah. I mean, in the beginning, there can be bone pain as the marrow returns to normal and the bones stop they get swollen and hard when that happens. But as the body returns to normal, the bone pain, as the bones readjust, can be very difficult to go through. There can be cramping. But it is also true that Gleevec wasn't working for everybody. Mm. Sometimes there would be those late-stage patients like LaDonna, although this didn't happen with her, but they would have these amazing responses and then relapse very quickly, very dramatically. And there was one of the investigators who was working with Brian Druker, Charles Sawyers, who's now in New York, saw this happening and just really wanted to figure out what was going on. Why would this drug work and then stop so suddenly? And why were there some patients in whom this drug did not work at all? Now, that's a small fraction, right? Mm-hmm. So we really have to put it in perspective that compared to what was the case, this was just stunning.
Yeah.
But there were these few that didn't work. And that research, his search for understanding why this was going on, eventually led to the creation of second and then third generation versions of the drug that could that fit onto this kinase in a different way.
So it was a different type of mutation, I guess, and that was the issue, was getting it to fit and to adhere right to the mutation.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So if you picture a kinase, like a lock and key, where you have the lock is the haywire kinase, and you're trying to create a key to stop it from working. Well, what you needed was Gleevec is a very specific key. It's a very tight bind onto the kinase. And when the kinase undergoes another mutation, which can happen, either it starts out with another mutation or it can mutate a little bit more, so not just the Philadelphia chromosome, but then it can get another genetic mutation, that can stop Gleevec from fitting. anymore. Mm. It won't bind to it in the same way. The fit, it just isn't as tight. Mm-hmm. And when the fit isn't as tight, it can't stop this signal from going to produce white blood cells. So these second and third generation drugs can fit a bit differently onto the kinase. Sometimes it's just a more permissive fit so that it can block more than one mutation, but yet not block other kinases, not fit onto other kinases.
Interesting. So is it safe to say then with these new iterations of the drug, has CML pretty much been wiped out in the sense that, I mean, not that it goes away, as you mentioned. I mean, you have to take the drug every day. Mm-hmm. But I imagine with the new iterations that there are that many more people now who don't have to suffer with it.
Yeah. I mean, probably if you're going to be diagnosed with cancer, this is the one you would want to be diagnosed with, which is obviously a silly way to put it. But, you know, one doctor told me he had a lot of experience working with other doctors in India and abroad, and working with them on, you know, showing them how to use the drug and how to treat any side effects that did occur, things like this. And one doctor in India said to him, you know, when I have a patient who gets diagnosed with CML, I tell them to go to the temple and pray and give thanks that this was your diagnosis. Mostly it works perfectly. Wow. This or the second and third generation versions. Pretty much there is now a kinase inhibitor for any CML patient. There will always be, you know, the patient that doesn't respond or that becomes resistant to the drug. But by and large, it's this is it. They've got a treatment.
And all of this from the Philadelphia chromosome.
Yeah. All of it can be traced back to this 1959 discovery of this abnormally small chromosome.
And what does this tell us, Jessica, about other types of cancer at the genetic level? I mean, what are the implications then?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question, is will this be replicated for other diseases? You know, I asked Brian Druker, you know, will there be a Gleevec for every cancer? And, I mean, of course, that's the hope. That's his hope. That's the hope that we all share. Cancer is diagnosed in about 1.6 million people in the U.S. each year. It's insane. And everybody just wants something better. His vision is, yes, absolutely, we want a Gleevec for every cancer. But it's not that easy, because most cancers don't have this one-to-one relationship. Mm-hmm. Most cancers have many mutations that are inside the tumor, and figuring out which ones are driving the progression of the tumor, which ones are not, and then how to target the ones that are, is a research, is a long time. Mm-hmm. Now it's been 12 years since Gleevec's approval. There are about 15 other kinase inhibitors out there. There's many, many more in the pipeline. But it will likely be another couple of decades before this work reaches its fruition, and other, not just kinase inhibitors, but other protein products can be targeted too.
Yeah. Speaking of Dr. Druker, he is absolutely beloved by his patients.
Yeah.
Just again, tell us a little bit about just his personality and kind of what is he doing right now, and just his relationship, the bonds that he developed with his patients over the years.
It is a very strong bond. It's very moving. They credit him with saving their lives, 100%. And if you go online and Google Brian Druker Appreciation Album or Dr. Druker Thank You Album, you get this birthday album that CML patients made for him, thanking him for saving their lives. Yeah. I mean, there's this man in there who, you know, has a three-year-old son, and he wrote to Brian Druker, I know, you know, that you made extraordinary sacrifices, but I think if you could, you know, see my three-year-old son and tell him that, you know, his father is alive because of you, you know, you would know that it was so worth it.
Yeah.
I always cry whenever I go to this website. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. But they credit him with saving their lives. And they also formed this wonderful community, this very warm community. They were all going through this experiment together. And the experiment continues. I mean, every new day that someone is taking this drug is another day in the experiment. This man's mother, who is now 79 and taking the drug, she's part of the experiment still. Brian Druker is still in Portland. As a result of this breakthrough, he had no financial stake in the drug, but his professional career, of course, took off. He's the head of the Phil Knight Cancer Institute, which is Phil Knight of Nike gave this incredibly large gift to the cancer center there. And Brian Druker is the head of it, so he's leading the research there. And he also has he works with Nick Lydon, who has been his research partner since the 1980s. Nick Lydon was in Sibagaigi. He was another person who shared the same vision of creating this drug. And they still work together, working on sequencing the genomes of tumors and doing what's called high-throughput screening. Mm-hmm. So trying to screen as many compounds as possible very quickly to try to find hits against these mutations.
Well, the book is called The Philadelphia Chromosome, and it is the subtitle is A Mutant Gene and the Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level. The author is Jessica Wapner, and what a fascinating story. And I do want to mention, too, that if you'd like to hear more from Jessica, you want to hear more about the book, Jessica is going to be speaking at the Free Library of Philadelphia this evening at 7:30. That's Free Library at 7:30 if you want to hear more about the Philadelphia chromosome. And Jessica, thank you so much for
being
with us here on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's great to talk with you.
I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. You have been listening to Radio Times, and our producers are Debbie Builder, Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Emily Bryant, and our engineer has been Kevin Griffin, and I'm Tracy Matisak here for Marty Moscowane.